One of the things that I enjoy just about every day is a good cup of tea. And one of the things that I like, or my perennial favorites, like the Irish breakfast tea, Constant Comet, English breakfast, of course, Earl Grey is quite lovely. Of the fruited flavors, of the herbal teas that are fruit, Perfect Peach right now, I have to say, is just refreshing and kind of a nice tea to have after dinner. And not caffeinated, so it won't keep you up. But my standard go-to tea, when I just want a good cup of tea, is Twinings Prince of Wales. And I have to say, it's kind of good. It's not quite as strong as Earl Grey. And it kind of has the flavoring of the Irish breakfast tea, too. So it's a nice mild tea to enjoy. Now, I do drink coffee also. I enjoy a good cup of coffee in the morning. And after all, in the United States, we tend to be more coffee drinkers than we are tea drinkers. And when we do drink tea in the United States, maybe most people, often, and actually to the horror of our UK friends, they put ice in it and drink it. Some of my friends in the UK think that's kind of appalling. And when they say that, I do remind them that it was their ancestors that caused us to be coffee drinkers. That is, in 1773, our taste for tea soured. And we started to drink coffee. In 1773, Parliament passed a tea tax on the colonies. And there had already been a growing distaste of taxes for the previous decade as England continued to pass tax upon tax onto the colonies. And that this final one in 1773 just became a tipping point. And no taxation without representation became the rally call. And though it was a little more complex than that, and if you want to figure out how the complexity worked back then, you just have to do what we always know, follow the money, and you will find how it is, how all the things came together. But when we think of the tea revolt, oftentimes what comes to our mind first is the Boston Tea Party, where a group of men and some who were costumed as Native Americans went down to the harbor. They went on board a couple of ships and threw the entire content of tea overboard so that it was completely useless. No more paying the tax on that tea. Almost a year later, in October of 1774, Annapolis had its own tea party. And in that, there's a painting that you can find in a Capitol building in Annapolis that pays tribute to this little-known event. The painting is The Burning of the Peggy Stewart. Now, it was October 14, 1774, when the Peggy Stewart docked in Annapolis port. The brig was owned by a Maryland shipping company under James Dick and his son-in-law, Anthony Stewart. Now, they and their shipping partners had intended to keep that shipment of tea under wraps, quiet. But before the ship even docked, word had gotten out that that ship was loaded with tea. So they had a dilemma. Do they pay the tax on the tea and face a possible angry mob, or do they refuse to pay the tea and risk alienating their British connections? So they weighed it, and they chose to pay the tax. Well, the people of Maryland did not like that. They had already outlawed bringing in that tea, and so they were violating the law. They were paying this oppressive tax that the Marylanders were furious about. And so there started to be pamphlets handed out, making a case against Stewart and the Williams brothers, who were part of the shipping company. And because the people were feeling betrayed. And they were already talking about an Annapolis Tea Party. Some, though, rather just go ahead and get the Williams brothers and Stewart and tar and feather them. Well, in an effort to quell the outrage, Joseph and James Williams immediately wrote to the committee for Anne Arundel County and apologizing by stating that they had great hopes that the tea would not have actually been shipped, that they were hoping that it would have not gotten on board that their ship. And Anthony Stewart distributed his own apology pamphlet. Actually, they were kind of lying about this. They were trying to sneak it in. But the zealots around Annapolis were not very satisfied about this. Eventually, the course of action came down to one conclusion. The only way to satisfy the Marylanders was for the tea and the ship to be burned to the waterline. So on October 19th, Stewart and the Williams brothers were loaded onto a boat and forced to move the ship to Windmill Point. Then they raised her sails and lifted the British flag, and the brig Peggy Stewart was run aground. And the ship, along with all the cargo, was put to the torch. The Maryland Gazette estimated that the next day that 2,320 pounds of that detestable weed had been burned along with the ship. As a result, James Dick was ruined financially, and he spent the rest of his days holed up in his home. And people would walk by his house and say, that's where the old Tory lives. Stewart was so widely notorious that he fled the colonies and petitioned the British government to repay him for his damages. They gave him a year's worth of income, and then later he was given an opportunity to come and lead a loyalist group in New York in opposition to the American Revolution. You know, whenever we talk about taxes, the discussion easily becomes heated. It even becomes heated when everybody in the room agrees about the subject, because taxes just get under our craw. Calvin Coolidge said that collecting more tax than is absolutely necessary is legalized robbery. Some have taken that and just said all taxes are robbery, while others would like to see more taxes, especially on those who have maybe a little more wealth. So there's, even now, especially with our presidential election six, 7 months away, people are already talking about taxes, and it's an issue. But taxes have always been an issue, and they've always been a source of controversy, even in Jesus' day. So, and this brings us to the topic today, the passage in Mark chapter 12, verses 13 and 17. So if you have your Bibles, I'd like you to open up to Mark chapter 12, verses 13 through 17. I'm just going to read and stop and read and stop and make some comments. And they went to him, some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians, to trap him in his talk. Now, they was referring to the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, who were considered, especially by themselves, to be the religious experts of the day. They were the ones that have already confronted Jesus in the temple, so they have sent the Pharisees and Herodians. The Pharisees were a very strict religious sect. They were strict leaders. They believed in separation. They also believed in the nation of Israel. They wanted to see an established, independent Israel free of Roman rule. Now, the Pharisees were not a major group, but they did influence great authority and influence on the religious establishment, and especially among the people. They were very traditional, and they hated Rome. Now, the Herodians, they were a political group, kind of like our Democratic or Republican parties. They supported Herod Antipas, who was there at the, you know, at the will of Rome. So basically, he represented the emperor in most of Judea. So the Herodians supported Herod, but they also supported the Roman Empire, And they were willing to compromise the independence of Judea, of Israel, in favor of Roman rule. So you can see that the Pharisees and the Herodians probably really didn't like each other, but they found a common enemy. And that common enemy was Jesus Christ. So they approached him. And it tells us immediately right here, they sought to trap him. In verse 14, they came and said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are true and do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances, but truly teach the way of God." Okay, everything that they just said, absolutely true. I'm imagining the way they said it probably meant that they didn't believe it. Their attitude wasn't really backing up their words. And they probably sought to put Jesus off guard by the flattery. Maybe they thought it would work because they were often put off guard by flattery. And it continues. "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not?" Okay, there's the hot button. Taxes. It's a hot topic now, especially as we just have finished up, or we're kind of still in with the extension of our income tax returns. It's still a hot topic there. So they're asking them. Now, they're asking them about the census tax or the poll tax, which represented about a day's salary per person per year. Not a huge tax, but an annoying tax. So the Pharisees, they hated it. They paid it because they felt they had to, but they hated paying it because it was just another reminder that Israel was not independent and that Rome did indeed rule. The Herodians, they were okay with the tax. Yeah, pay it. Yeah, we support Rome. We'll do whatever to allow that government to continue. So the idea here is if Jesus says pay it, well, the people, as most of us, we don't like taxes, and the people would have been like, yeah, that's so disappointing. Because most of the people wanted an independent Israel. Most of the people hated Rome, and they hated giving them their money. But if he said, don't pay it, he would be arrested by the Roman authorities. So he'll either be diminished in the eyes of the people, or he'll be arrested by Rome. So that's their trap. Verse 15, but knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, "Why put me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." Now, Jesus wasn't put off guard. He recognized immediately what they were up to because they were constantly trying to trap him. And he called it out. He referenced that they were hypocrites because, one, they were saying all these nice things about him, but they did not believe it. And then he asked them for a coin. Interesting that this group that's talking about taxes immediately handed him a coin. They all had them. The Pharisees had them. The Herodians had them. And they showed it to him. And while they did not want to pay tax, they didn't mind carrying the money of Rome with them. So, and they brought him one, verse 16, and he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said, "Caesar's." So the coin was minted by the emperor. It was considered, and it had his image stamped on it. It was considered the emperor's personal property, even while it is in circulation. You know, our Federal Reserve notes are $1, $5, $50, $20 bills. All of those, there is an executive order that we're not allowed to destroy those in a way or deface them in a way that makes them unusable. Because they are a device that communicates or represents value. And the federal government actually owns the device. We own the value. So it's similar here. The money, the actual physical money that we have doesn't really belong to us. The value does. So here in Rome, the coins belong to the emperor. On the head side of a Roman coin, the denarius, it had the image of Caesar, Tiberius Caesar. And it would say in the inscription, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus, which means son of God. On the other side, it just said high priest. So these are actually claims of deity by the emperor. So you can understand why the Pharisees, very pious in their religion, and the devout followers of God in Israel might have a little bit of trouble with these coins and then also paying that tax. They would have felt like they were supporting something that was not real, that goes against their beliefs. So Jesus answered them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God." So they had to figure out what that meant. And they marveled at his answer, because his answer wasn't just, yes, pay the tax, or no, don't pay the tax. His answer actually pulled them to something, to a greater truth. And it stunned them. If it is Caesar's money, give it back, pay the tax. But there's a greater obligation here. And Jesus pointed that out, and that is our obligation to God. Whether coin is in Caesar's image and belongs to him, then we need to ask ourselves, then what belongs to God? In Genesis, we learn that man was created in God's image. Image is the key to this passage. So if the coins belong to Caesar, well, give that to him. But listen, that which belongs to God, we need to give to him. So that means that as people who are made in the image of God, that we are not to hold anything back from our devotion to him. We are to dedicate ourselves completely to his kingdom and to his service. By being the people of God's kingdom, we extend that kingdom as ambassadors to everyone we meet. So it isn't about paying our tax. That's not the greater obligation here. And letting Rome do whatever it needs to do, that's fine. That's what Rome does. And we should not worry so much about that. We should be more concerned about what we are doing and God's kingdom, and sharing and expanding the borders of that to the people that we encounter.